Chapter 22. We had stories of small strange animals that were not animals, who could sometimes be seen in our forests, Tochi said through the Array's translator program. There are also stories of forests that have other forests inside them, hidden from normal travelers. But as we entered the age of reason and science, such stories faded into legend. Nobody in modern times has experienced either. Even I treated them as stories generated during our primitive past and used to explain some facet of nature, or act as a warning to younger family members. It was my venerable elder family parent who planted the doubt in my mind. Just before the elder died, it told me it had seen the small, not animals, and even ventured along a path to an inner forest many years ago when it was a youngster, before technology became so widespread. For me, the idea that such legends were not legends, but could actually be experienced, was too much to ignore. I made my plans quietly, without telling my colleagues, and set off to the forest where my elder parents said it visited the inner forest. I spent many days exploring, and eventually realized I was not only lost, but also no longer on my own world. And now I have my own stories to tell, which are greater than all of those collected in our archive.
"Wait," Orion said, a smile bursting onto his heavily freckled face. "You're a librarian."
The Array bleeped and said, "Non-equivalent translation inserted." Tochi said, "I am a custodian of our culture's history. I impart the stories of what was and what might have been to the youngsters of many families. This way our knowledge is not only maintained, but appreciated."
"A librarian?"
Orion grinned at Ozzy.
"That's nice," Ozzy said pointedly. Now that the translator was relaying everything they said to Tochi, it was becoming both difficult and embarrassing to explain away Orion's outbursts of laughter. The boy seemed to find a lot of Tochi's culture amusing. Ozzy had to admit, the alien's life did seem to be rather well, prim and proper.
"How did you know you were on another planet?" Orion asked. "Do your people have space travel?"
"I realized the planet was different to my own when I saw the sun in the sky was a different color, and at night the star pattern was different," Tochi said. "We do not have space travel."
"Why not?"
Orion waved at the gadgets Tochi was holding in its manipulator flesh. "You've obviously got the technology level."
"We do not have the need. We do not have the internal non-logic which you possess, the constant desire to explore without reason."
"You wanted to find the legends," Ozzy said. "Wasn't that an unreasonable pursuit?"
"Yes, and in that wish I demonstrated a wild aberration from my kind. If verification of my elder parent's story was required, then my colleagues and I should have begun a systematic investigation. I went by myself because I believed my colleagues would show no interest."
"Wild!"
Orion was giggling again. Ozzy flashed him another warning glare. "I'm interested that your people don't consider spaceflight to be necessary," Ozzy said. "If you've reached an advanced technological level, are you not finding diminishing resources to be a problem?"
"No. We do not build anything beyond our ability to sustain it."
"That's very admirable.
Our species is nothing like as rational. From what I have witnessed on my travels, that attitude seems to be in the majority."
"Yeah. But there are varying degrees. I'd like to think we're reasonably restrained. But by your standards, we're probably not."
"That makes neither of us right nor wrong."
"I hope so. After all, we all have to share the same galaxy."
"I believe that intelligence and rationality will always be primary, no matter what shape sentient creatures take. To not think that would be to doubt the value of life itself."
Ozzy gave the big alien a quick thumbs up. They were approaching another steep incline that was half rock. Tochi could scale such obstacles with the greatest of ease, while he and Orion had to scramble up, sweating with the effort. Ozzy glanced toward the sea on his left. They'd been walking along the top of the coastal cliff for 2 days. It varied considerably in height, but it was a good 20 meters high here, and there didn't seem to be a beach at the bottom. Not that there was an easy path down in any case.
"Up we go, then," he told Orion. The boy pulled a face and retied the band of faded blue cloth that was holding his long hair back away from his eyes. They both started to clamber up, jamming feet into narrow crevices, hands gripping precariously at strong tufts of grass so they didn't lose their balance when the weight of the rucksacks pulled at them. Tochi flowed up the incline, its ridges of locomotion flesh clasping at the rock and vegetation as it went. Ozzy hadn't asked, but he figured the big alien could probably slide straight up a sheer cliff. Once they were on top, they began walking along the edge of the cliff again. The ground was sloping down again now. He knew they were on an island. The small central hill with its crown of jungle had been in sight on his right for the whole 2 days of their trek. His array's inertial guidance unit was plotting their wide circular course around it. He hadn't told Orion yet, but in another mile and a half they'd be back where they started.
"Is that an island out there?" Orion asked.
Right on the horizon, there was a small dark smudge. When Ozzy zoomed in, it resolved into a solid little peak rising out of the sea, much like the one they were on.
"Yep, that makes five. This is some kind of archipelago."
"We haven't seen any ships,"
Orion said. "Give it time, it's only been 2 days."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm sure. There hadn't been any night since they arrived on this world. In fact, the bright sun's position hadn't moved at all. The planet was tide-locked, with one face permanently pointing toward the sun. Ozzy wasn't sure how the climate could function normally with such a setup, but then the gas halo was hardly a natural phenomenon. Between them, he and Tochi had used every sensor they had to scan the multitude of twinkling specks that were orbiting through the gas with this planet. The other specks weren't planets, that was for certain, although there was very little else they could discover about them. They weren't emitting any radio or microwave pulses, at least not strong enough to be detectable at any distance. That just left Johansson's brief description to fall back on. Giant lengths of some coral variant that was home to vegetation. He wondered if the Sylphon used them as cities or nests, or if they even bothered with them at all. Maybe they were just there to keep the gas in the halo fresh and breathable, as forests and oceans were to planets. As for their measurements of the halo itself, the best they could come up with was that it had a circular cross-section roughly 2 million kilometers in diameter that orbited 150 million kilometers from the star. What contained the gas was unknown, but had to be some kind of force field. The idea of building a transparent tube this big was mind-boggling, and introduced a whole range of engineering and maintenance problems. Exactly where the power came from to generate a force field on such a scale was also unknown, although Ozzy was pretty sure the builders must have tapped the star's power. Frankly, there was little else that could provide the kind of energy level required. Why anyone would create such an artifact in the first place was beyond him. It lacked the practicality of a Dyson sphere or a Niven ring, but then, if you had the ability to do this, you probably didn't actually need to. And if it was the Sylphon home system, he strongly suspected the answer to such a question would be, why not? He didn't really care. He was just happy someone had done it, and he'd seen it.
"Ozzy, Tochi, look!"
Orion was racing on ahead of them through the grass. There was no cliff here. The ground had dipped until it was almost level with the sea. A big sandy beach curved away ahead of them. The boy ran onto the sand. A dead fern frond was standing on top of a low dune at the back of the beach like a brown flag. Ozzy had stuck it in there when they started their exploratory walk. The boy's delight crumpled as he pulled the frond out of the sand.
"This is an island."
"Afraid so, man," Ozzy said.
"But..."
Orion turned to look at the small central mountain.
"How do we get off?"
"I can swim to another island," Tochi said. "If you are to come with me, we must build a boat." Orion gave the sea a mistrustful look.
"Can't we call someone for help?"
"Nobody's listening,"
Ozzy said, holding up his handheld array. The unit had been transmitting standard first contact signals since it started functioning again, along with a human SOS. So far, the entire electromagnetic spectrum had remained silent.
"If this is where the Sylphon live, where are they?"
the boy demanded.
"On the mainland somewhere, I guess," Ozzy said.
He stared out to sea. Three islands were visible to his retinal inserts on full zoom, though he wasn't sure of their distance. If they were the same size as this one, they'd be nearly 50 miles away, which, given he was now only a couple of yards above sea level, should have put them far above the horizon on any Earth-sized planet. He wondered if this one was the same size as Silvergalder.
"Where's that?"
Orion asked grouchily. "I don't know. In that cloud bank we saw from the other side of the island, maybe."
"You don't know that?"
"No, I don't," Ozzy snapped. "I don't get this place at all, okay?"
"Sorry, Ozzy,"
Orion said meekly.
"I just thought, you normally know stuff, that's all."
"Yeah, well, this time I don't, so we'll have to find it out together." He told his e-butler to call up boat-building files from his array's memory. Even in midsummer, the waters of the Trinebo were cold, filled with snowmelt every spring and deep enough to keep sunlight out of its lower levels. It guarded its low temperature jealously. Mark wore a warm suit as he drifted among the fabulous dendrites, fans, and arches of coral that sprouted from the main reef. So far, marine biologists had identified 372 species of coral, and added more every year. They ranged from the dominant dragonback, with its long amethyst and amber mounds, down to beige corknuts the size of pebbles. Unicorn horn formations poked upward from the patches of bright tangerine ditch coral, seriously sharp at the point. He was pleased to see Barry was showing them due respect. So many people wanted to see if they were as sharp as they looked. Warm suit fabric gave no protection for fingers and palms. Every year, Rantown General Hospital treated dozens of tourist impalements. Barry saw him watching and gave the circular OK signal with his right hand. Mark waved back. Cobalt ring snakes thrummed inquisitively in their niches as they swam lazily overhead. Rug pikes crawled over the reef, hundreds of tiny stork eyes swiveling as if they were a strip of soft green wheat waving in a gentle breeze. Fish were clotting the water around them like a gritty kaleidoscope cloud. Thousands of brilliantly colored starburst particles, whose spines and spindles pulsed rapidly, propelling them along in jerky zigzags. They came in sizes from brassy afrowebs, half the length of his finger, up to lumbering great brown and gold maundy fish, bigger than humans and moving with drunken sluggishness around the lower reefs. A shoal of eerie milk-white sloopbacks wriggled right in front of Mark's goggles, and he made a slow catching motion with his hands. The palm-length creatures bent their spines back to form a streamlined teardrop and jetted away. Barry was doing slow barrel rolls, his flippers kicking in careful rhythm. Both hands were clenched around flakes of dried native insects, which he was slowly rubbing apart. Fish followed him, feeding on the tiny flecks. They formed twin spirals in his wake, like intersecting corkscrews. As they ate, their unique digestive tract bacteria began to glow, illuminating them from within. Looking down on them against the murky bottom, was to see an iridescent comet tail spinning in slow motion across the darkness. With the food almost gone, Barry slapped his hands together, creating an expanding sphere of broken flakes. The Trinebo fish swarmed in, creating a galaxy of opalescent stars around him. Mark smiled proudly inside his gill mask. The boy was everything he could have wanted in a son, happy, cheeky, confident. He'd grown beautifully in this environment. It was becoming hard to remember Augusta now. Neither of the kids ever talked about it these days. Even Liz called her friends back there less and less, and he hadn't spoken to his father in months. He kicked his legs, closing in on his son as the shroud of luminous fish darkened and swam away in search of more food. The timer in his virtual vision said they'd been exploring the reef underwater for 40 minutes now. He pointed to the surface. Barry responded with a reluctant, okay hand sign. They came up into warm, bright sunlight that had them blinking tears against it as they searched around for the boat. The catamaran was 150 meters away. Liz was standing on the prow, waving at them. Mark took the gill mouthpiece out. "Got a long swim over there. Better inflate your jacket."
"I'm all right, Dad."
"I'm not. Let a little air in, huh? Make your mom happy."
"Okay, I guess."
Mark pressed the pump valve on his shoulder and felt the warm suit jacket stiffen as the fabric inhaled, puffing up around him. They rolled onto their backs and began a steady kick. Sandy was still snorkeling around the yacht, along with Elle, one of the Dunbavand kids. Lydia and her two lads, Will and Ed, were already back on the catamaran, washing their diving gear. David and Liz were starting to prepare lunch on the mid-deck. Panda barked delightedly as Barry swam up to the small dive platform at the back of the yacht. "Stay," Liz called. The dog looked like she was about to jump in and swim again. Barry clambered onto the dive platform and took his flippers off.
"Did you miss me?"
he asked Panda.
"Did you?"
The dog was still barking excitedly, her tail wagging furiously. Barry made a fuss of her when he climbed up the small chrome ladder to the main deck. He started to reach for one of the boiled eggs from the salad Liz was setting out. "Clean up and dry out first," his mother warned him. Mark helped Sandy onto the dive platform. She lifted her mask off and smiled happily at her father.
"I saw a grog down there, Daddy. It was hugely big."
Her arm stretched out wide to show just how big. "That's lovely, darling," he said as he pulled his own flippers off. "Did you put your sunscreen on before you went in the water?"
"Uh-huh,"
she nodded vigorously. Even though Sandy's skin was a lot darker than his, he was suspicious about the back of her neck and arms. They looked slightly sunburned to him. "Well, let's put some after-sun salve on, shall we?" Happy with the attention, she agreed readily.
"You shouldn't have taken him out for so long,"
Liz chided when he sat down and began applying the salve to Sandy's back.
"I was getting worried. And look how far away from the boat you got." "But, Mom, it was so clear down there today,"
Barry protested.
"You could see for kilometers. It's never been so good before."
Mark gave his wife a helpless look. How could you prevent a kid having that much fun? She gave the pair of them an exasperated stare and carried on with the salad. The catamaran belonged to David and Lydia, who used it during the summer months to explore the little coves and inlets along Trinaba's shoreline. In wintertime it was hauled up the Rantown Yacht Club slipway, so on the weekends David could spend hours in the boat shed painting the hull and repairing the rigging ready for the next season. Mark loved the yacht, and had already begun to think seriously about getting one himself. Not that they could afford one yet. It was a bit like having a dog and a 4x4, all part of Rantown. When everyone was finally washed and dry and sitting down to lunch, the catamaran's electro-muscle rigging unfurled its sails and set off for one of the tiny conical atolls that poked up from the very deepest part of the lake. They'd promised the kids they could visit one in the afternoon to see if the balloon flowers were inflating yet. It was almost time for the annual event, which Rantown celebrated with parades and a huge lakeside barbecue in the evening.
"The Vineyard Association said they haven't noticed any decline on orders," David said when the kids had all gone to sit on the stern to eat their lilan berries and ice cream. "I was at the meeting last night." "You should have come, Mark."
"Not sure I'd be welcome."
"Don't be so paranoid," Lydia told him. "You didn't even get your 15 minutes of fame. You were just a one-minute wonder that evening. All the media cares about right now is the Benelli murder."
"That barren woman is still using the phrase," Mark said. "According to her show, all of Rantown is anti-human." Everyone in the district was worried about the effect Barron's propaganda would have on their small economy. So far it hadn't been bad. After a 5-day standoff, the Navy trucks had eventually retreated back down the highway, and the tourist buses had returned. Of course, the summer bookings had been made months before. It was too late for anyone to cancel. The true test would be next season's bookings. A surprising number of visitors had congratulated the residents on making their stand. Mark's interview was politely never mentioned. In the meantime, people were watching to see what would happen to their small export trade of wines and organic food.
"Nobody on Ilan is going to organize a boycott, for heaven's sake," Liz said. "In any event, half of the wine we make is sold right here in the district.
And the kind of people who buy proper organic produce support what we did anyway." Mark nodded glumly and poured himself some more Chapel's wine.
"I might have got away with it then."
David leaned over and touched his glass to Mark's.
"I'll drink to that." "Come on, the future's looking good. Liz has almost cracked the Kinevine's rhizome sequence. Once we have that fixing its own nitrogen, we can sell it for cultivation right across the valley. People will be ripping up their old vines and replanting. There won't be a vineyard on Riceal that can compete against that wine when it crops.
It's going to take a little while yet, Liz said.
Mark put her arm around her.
You'll do it, he said softly.
She grinned back at him.
What in God's name are those?
Lydia asked.
She was shielding her eyes with one hand, pointing back toward Rantown with the other.
Blackwater Crag dominated the skyline behind the town. Then there was a short break in the mountains to the west of it, where the highway valley led back into the Dorsings. After that, the rugged peaks rose again to stand guard over Trinaber's shore. One of the tallest peaks on the western side was Goyal, the southernmost of a cluster collectively called the Regents, where the district snowbike sports and racing was based. Only now, in midsummer, when the ice and snow finally lifted from the sheltered high ground, did the little machines pack up for a few months. Black specks were circling slowly to the side of Goyal. To be visible from this distance, they must have been huge.
Bloody hell,
David muttered. He went straight to the cabin and brought back a pair of binoculars from the locker. Electromuscle pulleys began to furl the sails, reducing speed to make the catamaran more stable.
Helicopters, he said. Bugger, but they're big brutes. I've never seen anything like them before. They've got double rotors.
Must be some kind of heavy cargo lifter. I make that at least 15 of them up there. Could be more. He offered the binoculars around to the others. Liz took them. Mark didn't bother. He slumped down into the mid-deck semicircular couch.
It's the detector station, he said in dismay.
After everything we did, everything we said, they brought it in anyway.
The bastards.
Liz handed the binoculars to Lydia.
You knew it was going to happen in the end, Mark. Something that big isn't stopped by a bunch of people standing in the middle of the road.
I thought we lived in a democracy.
We do. We exercised our democratic right to protest, and they ignored us.
Ultimately, the Navy is a government department. What did you expect from them?
I don't know. Would a little sensitivity be too much to ask?
She went over and sat beside him.
I'm really sorry, baby.
I don't want them here any more than you do, but we're going to have to knuckle down and live with it for the duration.
These are strange times. We have to make allowances for that. Once this whole prime thing is over, and the warmongers and profiteers have finished frightening the life out of everyone, then the station will be gone. We'll make damn sure they take all their crap with them as well, I promise that.
Yeah, he sighed, conscious how he must be coming over as a petulant brat to the Dunbavans.
Yeah, I guess so. But I don't have to like it.
Nobody's asking you to. He drained the last of the chapel's wine from the glass and looked back across the cool, calm waters of Trinaber. The helicopters had already begun to land on the other side of Goyal.
Our worst fears have been proved right, the Guardian's spokesman said in a calm, significant voice. The Dyson aliens are preparing to invade the Commonwealth. They have an overwhelming force pouring through Hell's Gateway, which will be unleashed against us any day now. We warned you this would happen, and now, sadly, millions, if not billions, of citizens will be killed to confirm everything we have always said is tragically true. They will die because our Commonwealth's defenses are completely inadequate. We know that every person serving in the Navy will do their utmost when the invasion begins. We support them wholeheartedly in their awful task. But there are too few of them, and not enough ships. If we could provide them with assistance, we would, but that is not our arena. We will carry on our own lonely fight against the Starflyer creature who has brought about this disaster. It is not often we are able to expose one of its agents, for they are normally hidden and protected. However, in this case, the evidence is overwhelming. One person put forward the proposal to launch a starship to investigate Dyson Alpha. One person now governs the size of the Navy budget. One person knows the true size of the resources we need and continually denies us those resources. One person sends their murderer to kill their opponents. This one person is the most powerful puppet the Starflyer has ever used against us. It is President Doi herself. Be warned, and remember the true crisis we are facing is not the physical one from the Dyson aliens. It is the one corrupting us from within. We have always been honest with you. Now,
In humanity's darkest hour, we ask you to believe in us this one last time. Doi and her master are our enemy. She will obliterate us if left unchallenged. Challenge her. The spokesman bowed his head. I thank you for your time. The whole office was spending the morning filing reports and filling in finance department forms to cover the cost of the L.A. deployment. Thankfully, Paula just had to skim the summaries and attach her authorization code. That left her with some time to contemplate what had happened, although all she could really think about was Thompson Bernelli's murder. Tarlo and Rennie were busy sifting through the pitifully small amount of leads resulting from the pursuit so they could draw up an action plan. Alec Hogan had chosen to examine the camera images from L.A. Galactic in a virtual projection to see if the software had been handed over inside the station terminal. She didn't object. For all he was Columbia's placeman, Hogan was relatively efficient at his job, and it would keep him away from her for most of the day. As so often happened with the Johansson case, L.A. had become a problem that had multiplied unexpectedly and always in the wrong directions. Although on the positive side, she at least knew that Elvin was putting together another smuggling operation. At 11 o'clock, Rafael Columbia appeared in the office. He was dressed in his full admiral's uniform, with several staff officers in attendance. Everyone in the office stopped what they were doing to look at him. Paula stood up just as he reached the door. "Wait for me," he told his officers and closed the door. "Admiral," Paula said. She closed the file in her virtual vision that had been displaying the names of everyone she'd informed of a target arriving at Seattle, along with their time frame. He gave her a humorless smile as he sat in the visitor's chair.
"Commander, what can I do for you?"
"Ordinarily, I would say you can explain your latest fuck-up, but frankly, I think we've gone beyond that, don't you?"
"Los Angeles was unfortunate, although we did learn that..."
"Not interested. It was a half-assed operation from the start. And that is indicative of the way you run things. Some target appears out of nowhere, and without any planning or prior notification, you put an under-resourced team on pursuit duties. Not only that, but when things go wrong, you drag half of the LAPD into the operation just in time for them to watch it blow up in our face. We're a fucking laughingstock, Commander. And I will not tolerate that."
Paula saw how much anger was behind Columbia's steely expression and realized she was going to have to confide in him. "I'm sorry about the negative publicity, but I can assure you the operation was planned with considerable forethought. I used a small team for a reason."
"Which was?"
"I believe there is a leak of some kind in Navy intelligence. I have been running isolation and identification operations for some time in an attempt to identify the source."
Rafael Columbia's face darkened. "A leak," he said with false calm.
"There has to be."
"And you didn't bother informing me, nor Lieutenant Hogan, about this?"
"I was waiting for some concrete results first."
"So then you don't have a suspect yet?"
"No, sir, not yet."
"Outside your suspicions, is there a single shred of evidence to back up this allegation against your fellow officers?"
"I believe Venice Coast was..."
"Ah, the other very public setback you inflicted on us."
"As I was saying," she said forcefully, "Venice Coast was leaked. The unknown attacker must have received information from a source inside the Navy.
And this unknown attacker, who was wet-wired with the most sophisticated armaments the Commonwealth can produce, is working for Johansson Starflyer?"
"That is an option."
"An option you've been shouting very loudly to your political allies."
"Somebody has been deflecting my investigation for decades. I need to start widening my approach."
She just held back from telling him what Thompson Bernelli had told her. Rafael Columbia took a small paper screen from his pocket. He held it up as it unfurled. "Recognize him."
Paula stared at the image on the paper screen. "That's the Venice Coast attacker." The image had been taken from a bad overhead angle, and he was wearing sports whites, but she would never mistake that face.
"I'm glad we agree on something. That image was given to me by Senate Security. It was taken by a camera at the Clinton estate. That is the man who walked out of Thompson Bernelli's squash court after the senator was murdered."
"He wouldn't," she whispered in horror. "Sheldon eliminating his political opponents? I don't believe it. That's not how the grand families and intersolar dynasties operate.
Something is wrong about this.
Badly wrong.
Who wouldn't? Raphael demanded.
The murderer. Why would he be used to kill the senator?
I don't fucking know. But according to you, he goes around causing mayhem on the orders of a Navy officer.
I did not say that. And you're a fool if that's what you think.
Raphael Columbia sat back in the chair and gave her a steady look.
When I became chief of the directorate, I was just as impressed with you as all those media morons you play up to in your trials. The legendary Paula Mayo, who solved all her cases except one, and she's still working on that after all these decades, never giving up. So like all the other chiefs before me, I gave you plenty of space, and never questioned your methods.
After all, Johansson and his sidekick are just a pair of lunatic conspiracy fanatics spouting paranoid propaganda.
Kind of romantic, really, like pirates in sailing ships.
Because the only physical damage the Guardians cause is on Far Away, where nobody ever goes, and certainly nobody cares about apart from the Halgarths, and they can afford it anyway.
Except the pirates were actually the most bloodthirsty psychopaths who slaughtered the crews of entire ships and wrecked economies because of the trade routes they closed down.
You see the parallel here. It took decisive naval action to eliminate piracy. Now I gave you an entire department with unlimited government resources, tasked to do one thing.
I gave you that in good faith because you are the Paula Mayo. And everyone believes you are the one person in the Commonwealth who can run down Bradley Johansson for me.
I can.
You haven't. The reason you're still chasing him, and I'm sorry if this causes offense, but it happens to be true, is that you're an obsessive-compulsive. The only reason, Commander Mayo.
I am what I am, and that makes me perfect for the job.
I disagree. You have poor leadership skills.
You antagonize and alienate your fellow officers. You do not follow procedure. You do not believe anyone is capable of performing tasks as well as yourself. In other words, you belittle them and are distrustful of them, which is why we find ourselves in this whole business of leaks.
It has to be a leak, doesn't it? Because it couldn't possibly be your fault, your screw-up.
Would you like to say what you came here to say?
Certainly. As of now, I am appointing Alec Hogan to take charge of the Johansson operation.
No.
You will continue to be a part of the operation, of course, but it will be in an advisory role only. Hogan will direct the day-to-day running of this office and facilitate policy and strategy.
That is not acceptable.
You are a Navy officer. You will obey my orders.
I am not a Navy officer. I am not part of this bureaucratic farce. I am a police officer.
Not anymore. If you refuse my order, you will be dismissed from the service.
This is my investigation.
It is not.
Paula Z. Butler told her it had just been locked out of the office network. She gazed over the desk at Raphael Columbia. Some kind of shock was holding her body rigid. She could feel her skin cooling. Some sick feeling that she suspected was close to panic had begun to clog her thoughts. It was obvious Raphael wasn't going to accept a compromise. He wanted his man running the operation. L.A. was just the excuse. One thing was perfectly clear. She couldn't continue the investigation as part of the Navy.
Fine. I resign my commission.
Paula stood up, which made Columbia flinch. She picked the quartz cube hologram off her desk and put it in her shoulder bag. Then she took the rabacas plant from the windowsill.
Word of advice, Columbia said. Next time you get rejuvenated, get your foundation fixed dominance taken out. The clinics can make anybody normal these days.
She raised an eyebrow in interest.
There's hope for you yet, then.
Everybody in the office was sitting behind their desks as she walked out, holding the same position they were in when Columbia arrived. The only difference was the surprise on their faces.
Goodbye, she told them, and thank you for all the hard work you did for me.
Tarlo half rose from his chair.
Paula.
She shook her head fractionally, and he fell silent. Without looking left or right, she walked out of the office. When she got down onto the street, she walked automatically back to her apartment, a kilometer away. It was on the second floor of a centuries-old block that had a central cobbled courtyard, overlooked by shuttered windows. Narrow stone stairs wound upward in the kind of central well that looked as if it had been water-eroded rather than built. In her one visible concession to security, the solid oak door of her apartment had a modern electronic lock to supplement the ancient mechanical one. Inside there were three rooms, a bedroom, a bathroom, and the living room with a small kitchen alcove. She didn't need anything more. She didn't use anything more. It was somewhere to sleep, conveniently near the office, an address for her clothes valeting service. When Paula walked in, the maidbot was sitting passively in the corner of the living room. It had already run through its daily cleaning routine, polished the age-darkened floorboards, dusted every flat surface, and put her breakfast crockery in the dishwasher. She opened the window that overlooked the courtyard, and put the rabbicus on the little dresser beside it, where it would catch the sunlight every afternoon. With that taken care of, she looked around the neat living room as if searching for a clue. There was nothing else for her to do. She sat on the sofa that faced the wall-mounted portal, perching on the edge. Memories were filtering up inside her mind, memories that had never been erased or transferred into safe storage at any of her rejuvenations, memories she'd assumed were dormant. Right after her parents' trial, she'd gone back to the hotel with her police escort. That had been a big new tower in Marindra's capital, with its cube rooms and clean new furniture and air conditioning. The escort had left her alone, giving her a break before the Huxley's Haven government official arrived to take her home. Now the trial was over, she didn't know what to do. There was nothing to fill her time, no school to go to, no Koya to hang out with, no boys to eye up. She sat on the bed, perched on the edge, looking out through the big picture window at the capital skyline, and waited. Strange things happened inside her head. Koya's hysterical crying and pleading was still echoing around in there. And while her eyes looked through the window, all she could actually see was her parents being led from the dock. Her father's head hung low as his dreams and hopes lay broken around him, her mother equally haggard. But Rebecca turned to look across the court, meeting her stolen stepdaughter's gaze, and mouthed, "I love you." In her small empty Paris apartment, Paula whispered, "I love you too, Mum." Then, just as she had in that hotel room 160 years ago, Paula Mayo started crying. Preparation had taken many months. Vast amounts of resources and industrial capacity had been diverted from the expansion expedition being mounted on the other side of the interstellar wormhole, but Morning Light Mountain was finally ready. The other immotiles had been forming alliances that might eventually challenge its dominance. They were worried about its new technology. It knew that they had been experimenting with wormhole construction. Its quantum wave detectors had picked up the telltale fluctuations from any settlements across the Prime system. If it didn't act now, they would soon reach parity. Its advantage would be lost permanently. 328 wormholes were opened in unison. They were small, each of them measuring a meter and a half wide. Just enough for a 10-megaton warhead to pass through. The wormholes closed. Morning Light Mountain had opened them next to the primary groupings of all the other immotiles on the planet, inside the ultra-strong protective force fields that guarded them from the sky, and next to the sprawling buildings that sheltered and nurtured them. The warheads detonated immediately, wiping out every motile and immotile within a 25-kilometer radius. Even as the first round of nukes were exploding, Morning Light Mountain was opening the wormholes again, this time at the next series of targets, the subsidiary immotiles orbiting the Prime home world. After that, it targeted the first of the two solid planets, the second. Then came the innermost gas giant, its moons, the asteroid habitats, the outermost gas giant, industrial stations. The wave of obliteration rippled out across the system for over a day. Not that many of the remaining immotile groups ever knew they were at war. They had little or no warning of their doom. Morning Light Mountain's wave of assaults traveled across the star system faster than the speed of light. When it was over, when every other immotile grouping had been reduced to a lake of radioactive lava, Morning Light Mountain used the wormholes again. This time it sent connections through, microwaves or fiber-optic cable, inserting itself into the coreless communications networks of its vanquished rivals. Its thoughts and orders flooded into the minds of the surviving motiles, expelling their mental heritage, turning Morning Light Mountain into the sole sentient entity in the star system. Every motile was enmeshed in its thoughts as it took control of the infrastructure and spaceships that remained. For over a week it sent its billions of new motiles out to survey the wreckage and list the mechanical systems that had survived unscathed. Most of the farms and food production plants had come through intact, as had a great many industrial facilities. The information was used to assemble a strategy for integration, bringing together every production center in a single unified organization. It began to amalgamate thousands of motiles into new subsidiary groupings of itself, to cope with the huge demands of managing an entire star system. Without rivalries, and acting in conjunction, the combined industrial output of every manufacturing plant was greater than before. Synergy, the Bose memories called it. The aliens' concepts and words still lingered and lurked amid Morning Light Mountain's system-wide thoughts, even though the coherent article had long been erased. It had even taken the precaution of physically eradicating the immotile unit that the Bose memories had been stored in. All that remained now were memories of memories, disseminated information that manifested in the odd alien phrase. There was no concern left of possible contamination. It was pure now, a single life that lived throughout this star system, and was now expanding into a second. The effort to reach the Commonwealth resumed, with hundreds of ships flying daily through the interstellar wormhole to the staging post star system, carrying equipment that would build the next sequence of wormholes. Out of all the hundreds of billions of motiles hurrying to perform their appointed tasks, one did not obey Morning Light Mountain's instructions. Because such individuality was impossible to a prime, it moved where it wanted and saw what it needed. No other motile possessed the kind of independent thought structure that would question it. As long as it avoided the attention of Morning Light Mountain's main thought routines, it was perfectly safe to come and go as it pleased. For over a day it had been moving around the base of the giant mountain building that contained the original heart of the massive interlinked creature that was Morning Light Mountain. It didn't move as smoothly as all the other motiles. It wasn't used to four legs, nor the strange way they bent and twisted. But it made progress. In the background of its mind were the directives and thoughts of Morning Light Mountain, emerging from the little communications device attached to one of its nerve receptor stalks. It ignored them because it wanted to, a mental ability that other motiles did not have. Although the images and information coming out of the communications device were a useful guide to what was happening across the Prime system. High above it, dazzling lightning bolts lashed down repetitively against the protective force field dome, sizzling away to ground out along the top of the ancient valley. Clouds boiled along at a speed it had never seen before. They were thick and black, blotting out the sky as they unleashed monsoon-like downpours several times an hour. So heavy was the unnatural rain that rivulets formed across the force field, carrying away the water to the saturated ground beyond. Whole tides of mud were slithering around the protected sacrosanct valley. The motile regarded the new weather intently, with one thought starting to dominate its mind. Nuclear winter. Paula Mayo took the express from Paris direct to Wessex. She had a long wait in the CST planetary station there. The train to Huxley's Haven only ran once a day. It was dark outside when she eventually went to Platform 87B, which was situated in a small annex at the end of the terminal. The train she found standing there was made up from four single-deck carriages being pulled by a steam engine that could have come straight out of a museum. She'd forgotten that the journey was on a historical throwback. On any other world, such a contraption belching out thick black smoke from the coal it burned would have been prohibited under any number of anti-pollution laws. Here on one of the Big 15, nobody cared. She climbed into the first carriage and sat on one of the velvet bench seats. A couple of other people came in and ignored her. Just before their scheduled departure time, a guard walked down the carriage. He was dressed in a dark blue uniform that had bright silver buttons down the waistcoat, and a tall peaked cap with red piping. "Ticket, please, ma'am," he said politely. She handed over the small pink hard copy the machine at the end of the platform had printed out for her. He produced a pair of clippers and punched a small Z-shaped hole in the corner. "Won't be long now," he said, and touched the peak of his cap. The 150 years of cynicism and cultural sophistication that formed her usual defensive shell wilted away. "Thank you very much," she said, and meant it. There was a great deal of comfort in a culture that was so honest and straightforward. She held the ticket in her hand, looking at it as the steam engine tooted loudly and began to pull out of the station, amid a cloud of pure white steam and clanking pistons. In theory, Huxley's Haven represented home, though she felt no attachment of any kind to the planet and its people. Going back would seem, to any observer, and she was sure Hogan would be keeping a virtual eye on her, as if she were running for cover, returning to the one place she would fit in. There was the usual slow crawl across the planetary station yard. Other trains seemed to charge past, the lights from their carriage windows producing a smear of illumination. Signals were bright red or green points against the dark background, stretching away for kilometers like a thinly populated city. Every now and then the glaring front lights from a heavy goods train would flow across the silver rails, followed by the dark bulk of the wagons, eclipsing the rest of the yard. Their gradual progress forward took them into a pale amber light that washed across this section of the yard like strong moonlight. When she pressed her face against the window, Paula could see the gateways lined up ahead of them, over two-thirds illuminated by the daylight of the worlds they led to. In front of them, the rails were full of trains. It was unnerving seeing how little distance there was between each one as station traffic control arranged them in a continual sequence. Only the single track that the steam engine rolled along was empty ahead and behind. They curved around to face the gateway, which glowed with a diffuse primrose light. Paula experienced the usual tingle over her skin as they passed through the gateway's pressure curtain. Then they were on another world and in full daylight, picking up speed across a rolling countryside that was made up from verdant checkerboard fields. Dense, neatly layered hedges were used to separate out the land, with the occasional dry stone wall acting as a more substantial barrier. Native trees with reddish leaves were interspaced with terrestrial oak, ash, sycamore, and beech. All of them had been pollarded, their thick main trunks sprouting long, vertical branches. The farms used the cut wood for fuel during the winter months, reducing dependence on fossil reserves. One of the benefits of using such simple mechanical technology was the low energy requirements. All of the planet's electricity was easily supplied from hydro dams. She could see farmhouses sitting amid the folds of land, big brick buildings with blue slate roofs, nestled at the center of Dutch barns and pigsties and stables and store sheds. Some of them had grain silos, tall clapboard structures painted dove gray, which she knew were among the tallest buildings on the whole planet. Single railway tracks branched off from the main line, snaking out to the silo yards, through narrow cuttings and along embankments. The rails were rusty now, in early summer when the grains were still green in the fields. But later in the year, when the harvest was gathered, the grain wagons would make daily collections. The lines would be shiny again, and the weeds coming up between the wooden sleepers would shrivel and die from the heat of the engines and blasts of steam. Paula had to admit, it looked every bit the bucolic idyll. She accepted now, what she had so strongly rejected as a confused, uprooted teenager, that the whole point of this society was that it didn't change. That was what its people were designed for. The Human Structure Foundation had chosen a level of technology equal to the early 20th century, prior to the electronic revolution, the kind of engineering and mechanics that was easily maintained. Nothing here needed computer diagnostics when it broke down. Engineers could see what was wrong amid a machine's cogs and cables. It was the same with information. There were no arrays, databases, or networks. Offices of clerks and accountants kept books and files and Rolodexes. The Foundation had designed people to work at specific jobs, and those jobs wouldn't metamorphose with progress. There was no progress. Huxley's Haven provided its inhabitants with the most secure, stable society it was possible to have. She still couldn't decide if the Foundation had been morally right to begin the whole project, but looking out at the trim, neat fields and the picture-perfect farms, she had to admit now that it worked. The train started to move through the outskirts of Fordsville, the capital. They were climbing up on a wide embankment now, giving her a view down on the streets of the outlying districts. Long rows of neat terrace houses stretched away in regular lines, their bricks all a rust red, with broad windows painted in every color of the rainbow. Larger civic buildings stood high among them, sometimes as much as 4 or 5 stories tall, made from a dark gray stone. There were no churches of any kind, but then they didn't have any religion here. This was a world where everyone knew they had been created by man, not God. Even when the train moved through the center of the city, the buildings were all the same uniform size, neat houses interspaced by the commercial buildings, and plenty of large parks to break up the urban sprawl. It was unlike other cities in the Commonwealth, where money and political power collected at the center, and the architecture reflected that concentration. Here, equality reigned supreme. Alphaway, the main station, was probably the biggest single structure in the city after the original Foundation Clinic, with three long-arched roofs of iron and glass, tall enough that the clouds of smoke from the steam engines dissipated upward through the ridge vents. She walked down the platform and went out into Richmond Square outside. The roads were busy with three-carriage electric trams riding down their rails in the central lanes. More numerous were buses, whose methane engines produced a high growl as they raced past. Taxis and goods vans struggled for space among them. The only personal transport were the bicycles, which had two lanes to themselves on every street. People on the pavement hurried past. Many of them gave Paula a surreptitious glance as they went, which she found amusing. It wasn't fame that earned her the looks. Nobody knew about her here. It was her plain business suit that marked her out as an off-worlder. Contrary to Commonwealth comedians, whose routine had everyone on the planet dressed in identical boiler suits, people were wearing just about every fashion the human race had ever devised. The only thing they didn't have was artificial fiber. She crossed the square and went into the main tram station. There was no cybersphere here for her e-butler to consult, no useful stored information about routes and stops. Instead, she had to stand in front of a big colored map with the tram lines overlaid in primary colors and work out for herself which one she needed. 10 minutes later, she was sitting in a tram heading out on its loop that she hoped was going to take in the Earlsfield district. It was very similar to a vehicle she'd used last time when she left Huxley's Haven, though she couldn't remember the route number. As they moved away from the center, the number of large shops and warehouses decreased, and the streets became more residential, with blocks of factories clumped together. Watching them go past, she was still convinced she had done the right thing by leaving all those decades ago. After an upbringing in the Commonwealth, this world would have been too quiet. Not for the first time, she reviewed her nuclear option. Go for a rejuvenation and erase all her memories of life in the Commonwealth. Without that experience, the rich cultural contamination so beloved of her step-parents, she would be able to fit in here. It wasn't something she could bring herself to do. Not yet, anyway. There was still her first real case left to solve, though it had become inordinately difficult and complex now. It had begun in 2243, a fortnight after Paula had passed her directorate exams to qualify as a senior investigator. That was 9 months after Bradley Johansson claimed he returned to the Commonwealth after traveling the Sylphan Paths and set about founding the Guardians of Selfhood. As with any leader of a new political movement, especially one that waged armed conflict, he needed money to support his cause. As he no longer had direct access to the Halgarth family money, he hatched a simple plan to steal what he wanted. On a warm April night, Johansson and four colleagues broke into the California Technological Heritage Museum. They ignored the marbled halls filled with giant aircraft and even larger space planes, crept past the display cases full of 20th-century computers, never even glanced at the first G5 PC glasses, avoided the original motility robots, the SD lasers, a stealth microsub, the prototype superconductor battery cell, and went straight for the dome at the heart of the buildings. Right at the center was the wormhole generator that Ozzy, Fernandez, Isaac, and Nigel Sheldon had built and used to visit Mars. It had taken a lot of negotiation and political maneuvering, but the museum had finally acquired the display rights. When Johansson and his little team blew open the main door into the central dome, alarms went off and force fields came on. The duty guards responded swiftly and had the dome surrounded in under a minute. In order to prevent theft, the museum had laudably installed various force fields to isolate sections of the interior as soon as any form of criminal behavior was detected. As the central dome contained what was arguably the most important and therefore valuable machine the human race had ever built, its force field enclosed it completely. When it came on, it trapped the intruders inside. So far, so good. With over 50 armed guards outside the dome, the chief used the public address system to give those inside the time-honored recital to throw down any weapons and come out with their hands up and their inserts deactivated. The chief then tried to switch off the force field. That was when they found that on his way in, Johansson had burned through the force field generator's main power cable and the command links. The force field had come on automatically with the alarm, powered by its emergency backup supply. But for now, the guards couldn't switch it off. No real problem. They just had to wait 5 hours until the emergency backup supply was exhausted. However, what no one in the museum had really thought through was the nature of the machine that the dome's force field protected. Peering through the small gap provided by the wrecked door, the guards could see the intruders working frantically on the historical device inside. Johansson plugged in the Nyling desync his team had carried in with them, and slowly powered up the old wormhole generator. It might have been nearly 200 years old, but its components were essentially solid state, and Nigel and Ozzy had built it with a large, fail-soft redundancy factor. After an hour, Johansson managed to open a wormhole. It didn't reach over any real distance, not compared to its huge commercial descendants used by CST. That didn't bother him. He didn't want to go to Mars, or even the moon. All he wanted was to be 400 kilometers away from the museum, in Las Vegas. To be precise, in the maximum security vault that served the 8 largest casinos on Earth. With the wormhole established inside the vault, the team walked through. Once again a barrage of alarms went off, triggered by their presence, and once again force fields came on around the outside, designed to confine any thief who had managed to get this far until the guards arrived. One of Johansson's team used microthermal charges around the vault door to seal it from the inside. They then spent 49 minutes transferring bags full of banknotes back through the wormhole and into the museum. The casinos welcomed currency from every planet in the Commonwealth, and each bag contained notes to the value of 5 million Earth dollars. It took a team member on average 1 minute to grab a bag, take it through the wormhole, and go back for the next one. Paula Mayo arrived 90 minutes after the California Technological Heritage Museum alarm was triggered. For the last week, she had been working on the strange case of a stolen Nyling desync from a factory outside Portland. Nobody at the Serious Crimes Directorate could work out what anybody would want with such a thing. Any company that had a requirement for one could afford one. Now they knew. She struggled through the hyped-up crowd of reporters, then had to get past the small army of LAPD and museum guards that had the criminals encircled. She pressed herself right up to the ruined door, which gave her a narrow, awkward view into the dome, where one side of the venerable wormhole generator was just visible. Squinting against the sheet of air hazed by the force field, she could make out figures moving around. 2 weeks qualified, and she was actually watching the largest robbery in human history in progress. Once the last bag was dropped into the dome chamber, Johansson moved the wormhole exit again, this time to an unknown destination. The team labored for another 50 minutes, taking the bags through. Then they left, and a simple software timer function powered down the wormhole generator behind them. 2 hours later, the force field shut down. Paula was among the first people into the dome, supervising the forensics team she'd called in. The directorate wouldn't give her the case, of course. She was still a first-lifer and way too junior. Her abnormal heritage was never mentioned. Senior investigators with 20 years' experience were brought in to head the case, and she was given a secondary role on the task force. By morning, the casinos had confirmed that $1.7 billion had been taken. The media called it the Great Wormhole Heist. Senior directorate officials assured their contacts that the investigators would soon be making arrests. It simply wasn't possible to get rid of that much money unnoticed. Johansson, though, had planned well. He spent his cash with the kind of people who asked no questions, and certainly didn't make large unexplained deposits with banks. On Far Away, the Guardians began to expand their numbers and activities, starting their campaign against the Starflyer in the form of its principal agents, the Research Institute, with the Halgarth family as occasional secondary targets. The Directorate Task Force did manage to identify Johansson's DNA from samples of hair left in the dome. It meant nothing at first. With a multitude of people walking through the museum every week, he was just one name in 2,500 confirmed samples. He did have a query in his file, given the circumstances of his earlier disappearance from his family and job 5 years earlier. It was only when the acts of sabotage began on Far Away, and the Guardians shotgunned the Unisphere with their propaganda, that the Directorate investigators finally put it all together. Catching Johansson was an altogether more difficult task. He only ever used frontmen to make his arms purchases, and Guardian members to release his propaganda messages. All the arrests they made were peripheral. They never got close to him. Over the years, then decades, investigators left the task force or were reassigned, or simply retired from the Directorate. Paula moved up the hierarchy until she commanded the task force. Finally, however, even the task force was quietly dissolved and the Great Wormhole heist case was downgraded. Even then, she kept the case active as part of the overall Guardian's investigation. For 139 years, she had not quit. She couldn't. The tram stopped at the end of Montague High Street, and Paula stepped out. The town hadn't changed, at least not from her vague first-life recollection of it. When she looked along the street with its small stores and hotels, she could see it dipping down toward the cove at the bottom. There was a stone harbor on one side, she remembered, with fishing boats drawn up on the rocky bluff, and nets stretched out to dry. Flocks of big scarlet birds swirled overhead, tetragulls, whose oily feathers allowed them to swim almost as well as fish. Mid-afternoon wasn't a busy time for Montague. Most people were at work, leaving the pavement sparsely populated and the buses half empty. The nearest shop had two large bay windows, displaying well-dressed mannequins. There were no chains or franchises on Huxley's Haven. Technically, the economy was market communism, with non-essential goods and products allowed to be supply-led, which gave designers considerable liberty and innovation. The dresses on the mannequins were certainly attractive, as were the pashminas draped around them. Paula walked in to be greeted by the assistant, a young woman whose clothes were all chosen from the racks around the shop. For a moment, Paula found herself studying the woman a little too closely. But what exactly did someone designed to be a shop assistant look like? "Same as you," she told herself crossly, "an ordinary person." There was no specific shop assistant caste anyway. All the fixed dominant gene would give her was a behavioral trait for public service. She could just as easily have been a cook, or librarian, or gardener. It was only after primary school, which took them up to age 12, that people on Huxley's Haven started to choose what sort of specialty they wanted to follow within their predetermined sphere of interest. The assistant smiled faintly as she took in Paula's clothes. "Can I help you, miss?" It took a second for Paula to realize that she still looked younger than the assistant, even in a formal suit.
"I don't need clothes. Sorry, I'm looking for directions to the Denken house."
"Ah, yes." The assistant was almost pleased at the question, as if it was what she expected an off-worlder to ask.
"It's on Semley Avenue."
She gave Paula a string of directions and asked,
"If you don't mind me asking, why do you want to visit him?"
"I need some advice."
"Really?
I didn't know Commonwealth citizens used our free thinkers."
"They don't. I was born here."
She grinned at the woman's startled expression. Semley Avenue was still the same, a street of bungalows with tidy front gardens. The exception were the pines and conifers planted along the edge of the pavement, which had been tended properly over the intervening century and a half to grow into huge, sturdy trees. Their strong scent mingled with the fresh breeze coming in off the sea, giving the avenue a restful quality. It put her in mind of a retirement village. The Denken House was the last bungalow before the avenue opened out into a swath of parkland that ran along the top of the cliffs. It was bigger than all the others, in itself a bit of a novelty on a world where everyone earned the same salary no matter what their job. At some time, someone had built a big brick annex on the side, with a few simple high slit windows. It didn't really match the rest of the bungalow's chalet-style architecture. Paula walked up the little path to the front door and rang the tarnished brass bell. The garden was subtly different from all the neighbors, who favored rigid layouts of lawns, flower beds with colorful annuals, and the occasional stone birdbath or sundial. This garden was lined with evergreen shrubs to provide a range of pastel colors, and the lawn hadn't been mowed for a week or more. Paula was just about to press the bell button again when a man's voice said, "Coming! Coming!" somewhere inside the house. A moment later the door was opened by a tall man in his mid-30s, with untidy shoulder-length brown hair that already had several gray strands appearing. He was wearing a much-creased turquoise blue T-shirt and a pair of lemon-yellow shorts. "You're early." He gave Paula a bleary look.
"Oh, couldn't your mother come?"
"I don't have a mother." She could see his ancestor's face. His cheeks were rounder and the hair was darker, but that nose was the same, as were his expressive green eyes. The slight bafflement at everyday life was identical too. The man rubbed his face as if he'd just woken up, and looked closer.
"My, my, an off-worlder. What are you doing here?"
"Are you Denken?"
"Leonard Denken, yes?"
"I'm Paula Mayo, and technically I'm not an off-worlder." Leonard Denken frowned, then a startled expression appeared. He straightened up, suddenly wide awake.
Oh my, yes, of course, the last stolen baby. My grandfather."
"No, it was my great-grandfather who advised you. My father always talked about that. I need some more advice." Leonard gasped, then smiled broadly. "Come in, please. Do come in.
I'm sorry about the mess. My mind isn't quite as tidy as people expect. The house reflects that. Matilda keeps threatening to tidy up, but I haven't had a chance to compile an index yet. One day, yes, one day."
There were books piled up along both walls in the long hall, hardbacks and leather-bound tomes. Some of the stacks reached up to Paula's shoulder, looking terribly unsafe.
"I need to get myself some more bookshelves," Leonard said apologetically as he caught her looking around. "There are several carpenters in the street, but I just haven't gotten around to asking them yet. I need wood, too."
He led her into the big annex, which was a single room.
"My father intended this to be our library," he said, "but I seem to have subverted that a little."
Every wall was fronted by bookcases that reached from floor to ceiling, with every inch of space taken up. Leonard was now building new piles along the floor. It was only the back wall that had high slit windows, long since covered by shelving. The front two had large arched French doors that opened onto the bungalow's main garden, giving a superb view out over the cliffs and sea beyond. A big old desk had been set up in front of one, awash with magazines, papers, books, and cardboard files.
"Please sit down."
Leonard gestured to a spindly antique seat in front of the desk.
"Matilda, Matilda, we have a guest.
Would you like some tea or coffee?" "I'm afraid I don't have any Commonwealth brands. I do have some passable sherry." He looked around as if he were in a strange room, until he saw an old grandfather clock. "Or maybe it's too early.
Tea will be fine. Thank you."
A girl came through the door.
"This is Matilda,"
Leonard said. The adoration in his voice was almost embarrassing to hear. His face had taken on a dreamy quality as he smiled at her. Paula, who was used to the sequenced and modified women of the Commonwealth, was surprised by how beautiful Matilda was. She was in her early 20s, with delicate cheekbones that still managed to give her strong features, complemented by wide, ice-blue eyes that allowed her an unnervingly piercing stare. Her hair was the fairest blonde, and she'd let it grow very long. Right now it was gathered into a single braid that fell all the way along her spine to the top of her narrow hips. She was also tall, with long legs, whose perfect shape was produced by muscles that any dancer would envy. Paula could see that easily. All Matilda wore was a small pair of red bikini bottoms and a cut-off white T-shirt. Her skin had a rich, healthy tan. When Paula looked out of the open French doors again, she saw the towels in the garden where the two of them must have been sunbathing.
"I'd like you to meet Paula Mayo, a very distinguished guest from the Commonwealth," Leonard said.
"Hi," Matilda said. "What can I get you?"
"Just some tea, thank you."
Paula said. Sure. Her smile was guileless. Paula found herself smiling back. Isn't she lovely? Leonard asked when the girl had left. He was as shy and eager as a teenager who'd unexpectedly found himself dating the prom queen. I'm going to ask her to marry me. I think. There's nothing I want more, but I'm a little bit older than her. Not that she's ever said anything about that. Don't wait too long, Paula said. There'll be another 100 men wanting to ask the same question if you don't. And she's where she wants to be. That ought to tell you something. Yes. Oh, yes. You're quite right. He caught himself and sighed. I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to be asking you for advice. It's okay. I've had a lot more experience with these kinds of things. And I'm used to seeing age differences over a century or more. Love normally wins out. Yes, yes, of course. I must say, this is something of a shock, having you come to me. That's why I'm not handling this well. Your letters to my great-grandfather are around here somewhere. He waved a hand at the library's piles. I read them when I took over from my father. You had just qualified to be some kind of detective in the Commonwealth government. Paula had forgotten the letters she'd written. At first, they'd been a welcome contact with the one person in the galaxy who seemed to understand her. Then, when her insecurities had slowly abated, she wrote out of politeness. Eventually, of course, her job took up so much of her time. It was a very tired excuse. She should have realized Alexis would have kept the letters. It had been a very intense affair during the short time it lasted. Yes, I qualified as an investigator. I've been successful, too. No false modesty. He smiled in that proud way that stirred up a few too many old memories. Of course you succeeded. You'd be the best they ever had. Not that they'd ever admit that. I have your great-grandfather to thank. He was the one who told me to go. He knew that I wouldn't be happy here, not after being exposed to so much of the Commonwealth. I'd dispute that, but I'm not him, and you've obviously flourished. I have to ask, and I'm sorry if this is intrusive, but do you ever have any doubts about rejuvenation? You've obviously been through the process several times. I think you were a teenager when you left Huxley's Haven. No, no doubts, not ever. There is so much crime out there, and nobody else can do the job. She pulled a face. He was very similar to Alexis. A few might manage, she admitted. I'm asking because rejuvenation is the one thing that is debated endlessly by my caste. We simply cannot decide if we should adopt it here. I'd say it was contrary to your whole ethos. This society was formed so people could live their lives and be content. A great deal of that contentment comes from a natural cycle which lies undisturbed and was never sequenced in by the Foundation. They just give you the ability to enjoy what was available within a relatively simple framework, at least compared to majority Commonwealth culture. There will always be a job for you, whoever you are, a job or purpose that you will enjoy, and you will be rewarded financially by it no more or no less than anyone else. If you introduce rejuvenation, you will start to expand beyond the rate sustainable by your current economy. And your current techno-economy is the only one suitable for fixed-trait castes. The best the Foundation could sequence in was behavior suitable for a particular profession, along with a few extras like dexterity for doctors. But you simply can't produce dedicated fusion techs or microbiologists. Those kinds of professions have too many requirements. There's no single recognizable aptitude. To support a more modern economy, you'd have to despecialize the traits to the point where they'd effectively be dissolved. You'd wind up with normal humans, living in an economy that was ideologically driven rather than needs-related. There'd be nothing to stop them going and getting a better-paid job on another planet, especially after a couple of centuries of going into work in the same office. Goodness me. And I thought free thinkers such as myself were the only ones who could put together solid logical arguments. Matilda returned with a tray carrying mugs of tea. Don't let him distract you, she said as she gave Paula her mug. He's a very bad freethinker. He always asks questions, he never answers them. To think about things, I have to know about them first. Matilda gave Paula a told-you-so shrug as she gave Leonard his mug.
"What do you do?"
Paula asked.
"I'm a nurse. I work at the maternity ward of the local hospital. I like children."
She gave Leonard a meaningful glance. He blushed. Paula wanted to snap at him. "For God's sake, ask her." There was way too much recycled history in this house. A static, timeless society was one thing, but you could take it to extremes. At the time, over a century and a half ago, she'd been younger than Matilda, while Alexis had been older than Leonard. It had broken Alexis's heart having her leave, and he'd been the one who pushed her out, knowing it was the only way for her to have a future. Although if she could have been happy anywhere on Huxley's Haven, it would have been here with him. That was the trouble with freethinkers. They had overactive imaginations that made them uncertain. Maybe that's why they're always men. The Foundation just amplified their natural inability to make a commitment. Matilda looked from her lover to Paula.
"I'm going to leave you two alone to talk. Let me know if you need anything else."
She kissed Leonard on the forehead and went back out into the garden. As she slipped out of her scraps of clothing to lie on the towel, Paula had a memory flash of Melanie and Morton, a couple she could really do with forgetting about.
"Aren't you the perfect counter to your own argument, though?" Leonard said.
"Somebody recently claimed my Foundation trait was obsessive-compulsive disorder. He was an idiot, but he might have had a point. It is an excellent quality for a police officer to have. My type is probably the only kind who can adapt to the Commonwealth."
She paused, troubled by where her thoughts were leading.
"Freethinkers as well, possibly."
Leonard held his mug in both hands and peered at her over the rim.
"We're not quite as free as people think. If I had to define us, it would be as psychiatrists for society. The Foundation considered us necessary to assist this world in addressing questions and problems beyond the norm. As a collective, we are effectively the politicians. Our council is supposed to provide alternatives which everyone else gets to vote on."
His expression softened. "It's a bit of a myth that everyone else is sequenced to do as we tell them. Though I have to admit, were it true, the possibilities for dictatorship are fabulous."
"I don't think you'd make a very good dictator, Leonard."
"No, I suppose you're right. It is an irony that we are known for our micro work rather than our macro. I really do get treated as the local psychiatrist, you know. Any slightly out of the ordinary problem, and this house is the first stop."
"I'm as guilty of that as all the others."
"I understand. So what did you come here for?"
"You might need to prepare some options for this planet. Have you been following the news about the Dyson pair and the prime aliens who live there?"
"Dear me, yes. It's been in the newspapers, though I'm afraid we don't have many column inches devoted to Commonwealth affairs. But I have received briefing papers from the Commonwealth office here in Fordsville."
"Are you connected with that?"
"I used to be."
She started to tell him what had happened. 2 hours later, when she'd finished, Leonard's face had taken on a somewhat daunted look. He pressed both hands to his temple and exhaled loudly.
"Apart from me going up to this Raphael Columbia character and punching him soundly on the nose, I don't see there is much I can do to help you. Have you really been working on the same case for over 130 years?
"Yes."
"It's not in my nature to quit."
"No, no, of course not. I'm sorry, I'm just not used to working with this sort of timescale."
"So what exactly do you want to do next?"
"My instinct is to catch Johansson."
"Yes, I can see that. Well, of course I do have some discretionary power. It's in the Foundation's charter. I can have the Treasury pay you a monthly salary. It won't be much, but it will leave you free to pursue this diabolical man without worrying about money."
Paula laughed somewhat unkindly. She was beginning to think she'd made a huge mistake coming here.
"But it was just an instinctive thing to do. He was a freethinker, and the last link she'd have with Alexis." She let her gaze wander around the library, wondering what she would have done with the bungalow if she had stayed. The paint, furniture, wallpaper that could be used to lift away the air of academic shabbiness.
"Leonard, for 150 years, the Commonwealth has been paying me a good salary and even better expenses. I finished paying for my apartment 108 years ago, I eat most meals in the staff canteen. All I buy are 6 suits a year, and some casual clothes. After my R&R pension, all my money is paid into an SI-managed fund account. It adds up even with inflation. I don't need financing, but thank you for the offer. Then how am I going to help you? Freethinkers are supposed to be objective with the larger picture. I wanted your opinion on what I should be doing, even though that comes perilously close to absolution. What's religion? No, forget that. Are you saying I should tell you what to do next? Convince me, possibly. And yes, I appreciate you don't do specifics. I'm not even sure I can handle an overview in your case. What options have you got? It is in your nature never to give up. You know Johansson belongs in custody. Use your talent, Paula. Catch him. But should I? She murmured. Even saying it sent a cold shiver along her arms. Why shouldn't you? What if he's right? What if there is a Starflyer, a malicious alien that has been influencing human politicians? Dear me, is that likely? It does sound suspiciously like a conspiracy theory to me. I know, but there are an increasing number of inconsistencies in the case that I'm having difficulty with. Until now it did look like Johansson had very simple motivations, that the Guardians were formed first to help him steal the money from Las Vegas, then to cover up his subsequent lifestyle and allow him to live off the proceeds. But if he's right, and the Starflyer did somehow push us into the flight to Dyson Alpha, it would explain a lot of things. For one, he has never wavered in projecting his belief in the Starflyer. The only other person I know who could maintain such a constant position after so much time is me. Ah, now I understand why you have come to me. This is a moral question. Should you drop your pursuit of Johansson, even though you know for certain he has committed crimes, and go after the Starflyer, whose existence as yet remains unproven? That's about it, yes. She didn't mention there was no one else she could talk the situation through with. Right now she wasn't sure who she could trust. However flattering your appearance here today, I hardly think I'm qualified to give you a judgment on this. I have no knowledge or understanding of Commonwealth politics. And that's what this seems to be. No, it's not. Politicians and their aims are tied into this, very strongly in the case of Columbia. But it's not their squabbling for power which concerns me. It is the results of that squabble, and even if you doubt the existence of the Starflyer, I suggest you examine the name Nigel Sheldon. He is somehow mixed up in this. Whatever way I look at it, Johansson has been confronting something with political power, in which case he may be operating with another small political grouping. That would certainly explain why he's been given help from inside the Commonwealth government for so long. Wait a minute, I thought you said Sheldon was the one preventing inspection of the cargo shipped to far away. That's what Thompson Bernelli told me. So how could he be the one Johansson is acting against? I don't know. Presumably he's not. That's if Bernelli was right. If Johansson could convince Nigel Sheldon the Starflyer was a threat, there would be no need for the Guardians or the Great Wormhole heist. My old directorate and every other government agency would have been turned over to finding the alien. But he didn't convince him, although Sheldon blocked the inspections anyway. How reliable was the senator? In something like this? Completely. Leonard sat back, looking bemused. Then this is not logical. It would appear to be a paradox, only because, as yet, we don't have all the information. Hence your determination to carry on with the case. Yes, I see. But which part of it? A merry dilemma. Can you confront Sheldon? Given my current circumstances, I could probably get one interview with one person of power. As such, I would have to choose carefully. If Sheldon is mixed up with this, he will simply deny it. And it may be that I then face the same fate as the senator. Yes, to be avoided. Of course, if you were to catch Johansson, he will be able to supply answers for a great many of your questions. Finding the Starflyer would also end this. How would you do that? Travel to far away. If Johansson is right,
there will be an abundance of evidence at the Marie Celeste Research Institute. Won't that be somewhat dangerous? The risk is acceptable. No one will expect me to do such a thing. And it would be quick. I can see the appeal in that. The Starflyer would be the greater crime, which will allow you to pursue it with a clear conscience. If you're sure that's not a reaction to the shock of being dismissed from your position. It's not. I will catch Johansson eventually. However, I have to consider that given the Prime situation, I might not have much time left, especially if Johansson is right and it was engineered to our detriment. The whole purpose of exposing the Starflyer to the authorities would be to prevent any kind of conflict. Ignore the time factor. It is an unknown you cannot outguess. You have to go after Johansson. You know how he works, his pattern, and you now have a huge advantage. How so? If you work alone, he will not receive any leaks from your office. He won't know you're coming. She smiled thinly. You have more in common with Alexis than I thought. Why, thank you. So, how will you go about the case now? I will travel to far away and contact the Guardians. They will take me to Johansson. As you said, he won't expect me to come at him from that direction. Oh dear, oh dear. I suppose you know what you're doing, but please, be careful. I'd like to think my great-grandchild will sit here listening to your next quandary. She stood up and offered her hand. Tell him to watch out for me. You really are going to take my advice? It helped me focus on what I have to do, yes. He looked out of the French doors at Matilda, who was still stretched out on a towel. Then I really should take your advice. A huge black Zill limousine was parked outside the entrance to Paula's apartment building, almost completely blocking the street. She was surprised the police hadn't towed it away. At the very least, they should have fined the driver. As she drew up level, a gull-wing door in the side lifted up silently. A man whose skin was pure gold put his head out. "We need to talk," he told Paula.